You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
So Dr. Faiz, a SAIG renowned scholar and UN rapporteur, observed in 1970 in an essay the incongruity of the creation of Israel and the expansion of consolidation of settler colonialism, quote, in a historical era marked by universal rejection of colonialism in principle and near total liquidation of colonial empires in practice. So that's the irony. It's like, here's like the latest colonial outpost in the midst of a period that's known for decolonization. So that same year, the same year that French occupation forces crushed the uprising in Madagascar, Zionist militias waged a deliberate campaign of terror and expropriation, razing Palestinian villages, taking or destroying their property, and above all, taking their land. And from 1947 in December to July 1949, militias drove more than 800,000 people, that is 80% of the Palestinian population, from their land, destroyed or emptied over 500 villages, demolished homes, setting some homes ablaze, blowing them up, knowing that families were inside. And I'm not going to repeat the story because you all know that story. But it is worth noting two things. One, the leading settler militias, and especially its leader, David Ben-Gurion, claimed to be fighting on behalf of labor. It was a labor party, the Jewish working classes. The workers, so-called workers' state of Israel, passed laws barring Palestinians' right to return or retrieve their property, which is a very unlaborly thing to do. The man who called himself Zionist Lenin wrote in his diary in 1948 that in their war of dispossession, quote, we need to harm Palestinians without mercy, women and children included. During the operation, there is no need to distinguish between guilty and not guilty. That's what's happening right now. Like the majority of Israelis, Jewish Israelis, have decided that there are no innocents in Gaza, that everyone is good. It doesn't matter. You could be newborn. You're not innocent. And that's what David Ben-Gurion's saying. There's no innocence in our quest to take the land and homes and olive groves and everything. The colonization of Palestine was swift, was violent, it was patently illegal, even by UN standards. And yet, that act of colonization was backed by all Western liberal democracies, those nations that claimed to have defeated fascism. Zionism turns the history of Jewish displacement, expropriation, and terror into class rule and colonial violence. So with respect to Palestine, my friend and colleague, Nader Shalhoub Kevorkian, who's one of the most brilliant people on the planet, insists that we recognize dismemberment as a critical feature of colonial violence, not just with respect to the literal body, but in separating people from native and ancestral lands, from plant and animal relations, and therefore from culture, the culture, the memory, the life worlds, and ancestors that tie them there. Expropriation, displacement isn't just spiritual death, but literal death. The process of ethnic cleansing, occupation, the transformation of land into real estate creates killing fields. In her essay titled Ashla and the Genocide in Gaza, Livability Against Fragmented Flesh, which I think everyone should read, theorizes the politics of Ashla, which is Arabic for scattered flesh, a term that she found kids were using in Palestine to describe loved ones, teachers, friends whose bodies were blown to pieces by Israeli bombs and snipers. And she argues that to the colonizer, Palestinian people in Palestine as a whole entity is unthinkable. Their destruction is mandatory. The raison d'etre for Israel's creation as a settler colonial state, not just in whole or in part, but in parts. But Ashlah is also a demand for wholeness, for remembering. She describes breastfeeding women who rush to the hospital to feed infants whose mothers were turned into Ashlah. She writes, "It is against the production of displaced and shredded corpses that relatives, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers recreate relationships and innovate life. They turn necrophilic settler colonialism upside down when they breastfeed in a genocide," right? Speak of, collect, hold, gather, and embrace Ashlah. That is, in some ways, the dead, the shredded. Dismembering and scattering flesh exceeds extermination. It is overkill, intended for display. It is meant, in her words, to mutilate the killed and turn the killed body into mere flesh, unrecognizable as human, to dehumanize them and their bodies. And this is all being live streamed, right? Now, those of us, and there's a lot of Black people in this room, know, when you say dismemberment, we know exactly what that means. The necropolitics in the United States is what lynching is all about. It's about dismembering the body. They don't just take a life, and they keep it for souvenirs. Rape is also a form of dismemberment, of gendered racial violence, and an assertion of sovereignty. We see this in slavery, right? And it continues well after. Nadra sees the objective behind Israeli sexual violence to invade and violate the intimacy, sexuality, and bodily integrity of the colonized, right? In the production of these slaughtering zones, sexuality, the body, the dismembered wholeness of the colonized are all determined by the sovereignty of the settler state. So, to end this, the Nakba never ended. The violence never ended. The genocide we are witnessing in Gaza today really began in 1948, and like other forms of settler colonialism, it is an expression of fascism, which means the long Palestinian struggle for freedom and self-determination is both an anti-colonial and an anti-fascist struggle. The last thing I want to talk about is the U.S. So Césaire writes, "I make no secret of my opinion that at the present time, the barbarism of Western Europe has reached an incredibly high level, being only surpassed, far surpassed, it is true, by the barbarism of the United States." Now, some of you may not have gotten to the end of discourse, but that's what he says on page 47. Black radical intellectuals in the U.S. were saying much the same thing, but they argued that fascism was on U.S. soil. So it didn't appear as a boomerang, at least not on the surface, since they were talking about homegrown fascism a la Langston Hughes. They saw the post-war peace as a ramping up of fascism at home. St. Clair Drake, sociologist and noted anti-fascist and co-author with Horace Caton of Black Metropolis, which is about this city, the landmark two-volume study of Chicago's South Side, published in 1946, right? They were saying that this moment when Black men who had helped defeat fascism were facing unemployment and an uptick in racist violence, they predicted, and I quote, "The Negro may again become a chronic relief client, despised by the majority of white citizens who have to support him from taxes in the symbol around which the aggressions of a frustrated society can be organized so that he may fill the role of, quote, the whipping boy for an emerging American fascism." And that's what's happening now, right? Such an outcome could be avoided, they argued, so long as the U.S. achieved full employment and the entire world embraced, in their words, a program for emancipating the common man. The problems arise in Bronzeville's 47th Street encircle the globe. A blow struck for freedom in Bronzeville finds its echo in Chongqing and Moscow, in Paris and Senegal. A victory for fascism in Midwest metropolis will sound the knell of doom for the common man everywhere. So they're saying if fascism continues, this is basically the death of all of us. Now, of course, Drake and Caton were skeptical, to put it mildly. Caton writes this opinion piece in the Pittsburgh Courier in 1945, where he told readers, quote, we told readers that military victory abroad did not mean war against fascism was over. And then he writes, we now turn to the war within our own country. Victory for democracy will mean some chance of a peace. Victory for our own native fascism, the Hitler which lives inside of us, or in the nation, will mean that we're setting the stage for the next world war. And his warning was echoed by black communist Claudia Jones, who argued in 1946 in an article that fascism was alive and well in the Jim Crow South, evidenced in part by the revival of lynching in the beatings and assassinations of black veterans. She observes, today the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces, which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy. Replace semi-feudal economy for Silicon Valley, and basically it's the same thing. Okay, so in closing, whether we continue to use the term fascism, you know, I mean, I'm not mad at you if you do or don't. Most of the modern wars and catastrophes that have displaced like over 123 million people today have roots in the vestiges of the colonial order. And I'm arguing that that order is still with us. People deported or detained, indigenous people across the planet perpetually killed by the state and incarcerated in disproportionate numbers, subject to ongoing dispossession, resource extraction, and the violation of sovereign rights and so forth. And by the way, I live in LA. People don't realize that a lot of people being picked up, they're almost all indigenous. Spanish is not even necessarily the first language, right? There's 20 indigenous languages spoken in LA alone. And so these are indigenous people who are being picked up and kidnapped, okay? So that's really, really important to realize. If we think of conjunctures, not as singular moments or periods in a unitary world, but rather multiple overlapping concentric circles, which is the way I think about conjunctures, in a combined and uneven world, then we can talk about a very long colonial conjuncture that is still with us now. And that would mean, for those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. You cannot have socialism without decolonization. And just to circle back, I mean, you take the question of Palestine, in many ways, there is truth in the assertion that Palestine is the last colonial outpost, the last anti-colonial war. However, that implies that the world is decolonized, and this is not true. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact on a global scale. It just takes on a different form or appearance. So we look for domination through state forms, but often it takes the form of transnational, multinational, and non-national corporate entities that drive and manage global production of commodities. I mean, who are the beneficiaries of genocide of war? Hewlett-Packard, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and the like. So how different are these from the joint stock companies of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, responsible for colonizing Africa, Asia, and the Americas? What is clear, however, is that the unnamed and unacknowledged colonial violence today is arguably more brutal and more pervasive than the era of high colonialism, you know, of the 19th and mid-20th century. In the 21st century, we are living with more violence, more war, more weapons, more lethal capacity, more military bases, more displacement, more land grabs than a century ago. And if you consider, just pay attention to the Eastern Congo, extending to Uganda and Rwanda, with China providing military support for the Democratic Republic of Congo to protect its own investments in cobalt mining, By most estimates, 7 million people have been internally displaced in eastern Congo. So the boomerang keeps being thrown back, sometimes with even more lethal force. So we can't just celebrate the boomerang hitting the Europeans because they keep throwing it back. And by Europeans, that's not just Europeans. They're also the BRIC countries. We'll talk about that. I didn't plan to talk about that because I've talked about it before, but, you know, be mad at me if you want to. But there's a rearrangement of power, right? It's still a colonial relationship. And despite, like, 85 years of international law, the UN, all these institutions purportedly designed for world peace in a decolonized world, despite all that, nothing has been able to stop the boomerang permanently. So Césaire writes, "The hour of the barbarian is at hand, the modern barbarian, the American hour. Violence, excess, waste, mercantilism, bluff, conformism, stupidity, vulgarity, disorder." Right? So I'm saying that we are living in the American hour, not as a rising empire, but a dying one. Stuart Hall calls it iron times. Gramsci calls it an interregnum in which, quote, morbid phenomena of the most varied kind come to pass. Last thing I want to say is I do think that Césaire's conclusion is fundamentally correct, though we must be precise about what he is saying in that conclusion. I'm not going to read it, but I want you to read it yourself, to recognize that he is speaking of the salvation and not redemption of Europe. So just read a short passage. He writes, "The salvation of Europe is not a matter of a revolution in methods. It is a matter of the revolution, capital R, the one which, until such times as there is a classless society, will substitute for the narrow tyranny of a dehumanized bourgeoisie, the preponderance of the only class that still has a universal mission, because it suffers in its flesh from all the wrongs of history, from all the universal wrongs, the proletariat." By proletariat, he's talking about sort of global, but here he's specifically talking about the European proletariat because he's talking about the salvation of Europe. What is he saying? He says, it is the European proletariat that's key, not because it is the most advanced, right? Not because it controls the most developed productive forces, but because Europe is an invention founded on racial and gender hierarchy, not unlike the Negro, the savage, and so on. Europe needs to be destroyed, right? And by Europe, Europe's not just that, you know, part of Asia. I mean, Europe has actually become a global phenomenon. The proletarian revolution, a true one, must rid itself of hierarchies of human, one of the gifts of a decadent bourgeoisie. It is only then that Europe can free itself and join the rest of the world in the class struggle. And this is what he's saying. Of course, that was the hope in 1950 or 55. That time has passed. But we are in a new time, but we're also in an old one. The colonial conjuncture is still with us. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is a fight against colonialism, is a fight against capitalism, and we can't be parsing out the places that we think we have to respond to in a state of emergency and the ones that we think are friendly to us that have been killing us the whole time. Thank you. One thing, I'm going to answer it with some sort of definitional terms, but also with questions, and I'll be very, very brief. I mean, we have to think of the state certainly as a historical phenomenon, something Stuart Hall talks about, not a thing or unitary structure, but a set of relationships. And, of course, state and state forms long predate capitalism. You know, so what we're talking about is a very specific state form or set of forms that come out of the bourgeois democratic state, right? Or the bourgeois state, or there's a colonial state, the colonial state, the liberal state, you know, the fascist state, and all have much in common. So one question, of course, we have to ask, can we actually in 2025 speak of a socialist state? There's never been, as far as I know, a modern state in any society that was not non-carceral. In other words, all states were carceral. And that's one of the things we have to pay attention to. The socialist states of all, they don't abolish the death penalty. They build prisons. And oftentimes, you know, coming out of the left of, in the 60s and 70s, prisons were not prisons were sometimes celebrated, right? Firing squads were celebrated. You read the Cuban Revolution and what things were happening as what's considered revolutionary violence. Of course, we don't think that way, but the context is very, very important. I think the context for states is always important. Let's talk about council democracy. I'm glad you brought this up, because one of the things that is worth thinking about is that we did have moments of council democracy. In other words, it's not a dream. The Soviets, whether you're talking about, you know, in Russia, whether you were talking about in Italy, they existed. Some amazing democratic practices took place in that immediate, you know, revolutionary moment in Russia, where you have Soviets as big as like thousands of people figuring out ways to work cooperatively, to make decisions collectively. And of course, they were crushed. Why? We know in the case of Italy, in the case of the Soviet Union, it's a little different. I think we can speak of state apparatuses that may be distinct, fractured, and have different functions. And here I'm talking about, I guess I'm being a little bit less abstract and thinking about how we actually interact with the state. Like, what does the state actually mean to us? Sometimes it is the DMV, right? Sometimes it is the very structures that distribute goods and services. That's what it looks like. Sometimes it's actually in the form of public education. The fact that the state is highly contested is, I think, worth thinking about. The fact that the state is fractured and does different things, that means it's not really the state, although in many ways it's all connected. Yes, there's a coercive arm to the state, but coercion also takes a form of law. We often think of the coercive arm of the state just in terms of police, military, the physical presence of violence, but it's also law. And the state that we're looking at now, the so-called deconstructed state, which is not being deconstructed at all, it's just being repurposed, actually is not only making new laws, but has basically kind of abandoned even the pretense of the rule of law. Okay, and the last things I just want to say is that there are lessons to be learned from history. I know. I mean, that's what I do for a living. There are many places for us to plug into different practices in projects that are beyond the state. And I just want to make a plug for one, Sweetwater Foundation, which is right here in Chicago, which is organizing beyond the state, providing food, organic food, skills. They build, they grow, they teach. And they're right here in Chicago. Emmanuel Pratt, Gia Pratt, they're creators. And so there's so many spaces that we cannot abandon in our sort of panic, right? Which we can't panic. You know, if you've watched enough Twilight Zones, you know you can't panic. You know, you have to basically keep straight focus, and that's, I think, what we need to do.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuc, Azad Issa, Claudia de la Cruz, Vijay Prashad, Chris Hedges, Gabor Mate, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism, and for Eduardo Galeano's classic book, Open Veins of Latin America, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk. Bye-ya.
Listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most pilots are trained to avoid extreme weather. But when a hurricane forms over the ocean, an elite crew of pilots, engineers, and meteorologists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration flies right into the heart of the storm.
So what will probably seem like the bumpiest commercial flight you've ever been on for us may be just a normal day at the office.
John Zoislek is flight director at NOAA's Aircraft Operations Center, which leads the Hurricane Hunters. Starting several days before a hurricane makes landfall, the team runs carefully planned missions into the storm. They fly on rugged turboprop aircraft equipped with Doppler radar systems and other instruments that measure wind speed, humidity, air pressure, and more.
We're in the actual storm, the turbulence, the rainfall, the heavy winds and rain, to really get those really, really high-resolution measurements that we need to understand the storm.
The information they gather is then used to improve forecasts and identify vulnerable communities, so emergency managers can help the public prepare.
We fly for the public. We fly to save lives. We fly to protect property.
So as climate change causes more extreme weather, the Hurricane Hunters are collecting important data that can help keep people safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.